This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, September 16th, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. Reporters on Deadline and policymakers balancing interests don't always have the skills necessary to evaluate the quality of data and the use and abuse of that data. Trevor Butterworth is director of Sense About Science USA and an editor at stats.org. For the most recent edition of Cato Connects, we discussed good science and his group's effort to improve data analysis for the public good.
We want to see a debate about evidence. We want to see evidence in the public realm. We want to equip people with evidence. We want to equip people with the tools to understand evidence. And then what they do with that is really their business. But we want to start with the basics, with improving scientific and statistical literacy in society. And when people make claims, whether they be in government or business or in the media, that people are empowered to ask to see the evidence behind those claims.
As we were talking before we started here live, the headline, "Thousands of Planes Land Safely," is not one you're likely to see. And that's also true of science research. Something that is novel, something that is new, is something that we are more likely
absolutely. There was a great line by an English journalist, Peregrine Worsthen, who once said, what are more true, the advertisements in the newspapers or the news stories? And when it came to things like risks and when it came to planes, plane flights, thousands of planes take off every day and land, but that isn't a news story. Yet that's the sort of the narrative bias that journalism operates under, novelty. Now, the problem of thinking about novelty in terms of science is that what's novel in science isn't necessarily true. It needs to be replicated. It needs to be analyzed. So there's always a break within the scientific community on accepting novelty. But when journalism and science meet, novelty becomes news. And inevitably, the storyline, the dramatic finding, the miracle cure, the alarmist scare, they become the sort of the lenses that journalists often write these stories, you know, under understandable deadline pressure, and because those stories are actually readable as opposed to the technical difficulty of wrestling with data.
One of the related issue here with respect to how journalists do their jobs, quite often what is a mere conflict of interest, which is, of course, a problem, is immediately transposed with a distortion of the data. So in that respect, who is Kevin Folta, and why is his story instructive?
So Kevin Folta is a scientist at the University of Florida, plant scientist, and a very sort of public communicator about the value of genetic modification. And he came under scrutiny by the U.S. Right to Know, which is a nonprofit organization that uses FOIA requests to get emails from scientists for the potential collaboration with industry. A trove of such emails were released by the University of Florida, and it appeared that despite having said that he did not accept money from industry, he had in fact taken a $25,000 grant from Monsanto to communicate about the against the myths of GM, surrounding genetic modification. And this led to a massive 2,000-plus word story in the New York Times and a great deal of sort of agitated conversation within both the scientific community and the advocacy community about conflict of interest. And what was interesting to me in looking at this was that it was a bit like, you know, sort of being told that, and forgive me for using a soccer metaphor, that Barcelona was playing Real Madrid for the Champions League Cup and then not telling me who won. Conflict of interest is an important, and as we're going to talk about later when it comes to the pharmaceutical industry, a really important issue. But it has to be accompanied by what might say the conflict of evidence. What Folta was doing in his research, was it good research? Was it valid research? Were there any problems with that research that might be tied to these affiliations? Well, the best the New York Times came up with was there is no evidence that academic work was compromised, in which case, what's the real truth value of the story? I mean, if we want to talk about, if we want to make better decisions in our lives, surely we should know whether Kevin Falter is a good scientist and did good science. But that was hardly part of the equation, and it hasn't really been part of the discussion. And that's a problem. That's a real problem, because if he's true, if his work is true, then it should, at some sense, stand alone on the merits of being true or valid or probable.
All right. Another case that you point to is a study that was done on BPA,
yeah,
which stands for?
Bisphenol A. So bisphenol A is used in many different applications, but the most prominent is in the epoxy linings of aluminum cans. And it's there to ensure that the seal it retains its integrity. So cans are often two or three or four part constructions. So the seal can be, you know, you don't want pathogens getting in. You want the food in the can to be safe, and when, especially when you have to heat treat it. So there are all sorts of good reasons for the chemical to be there. But we've also had a sort of 17-year, 18-year crusade against BPA in which something remarkable happened. One government agency claimed that through the research it funded that there were lots of dangers. And then two other government agencies, the EPA and the FDA, funded lots of research to say that there wasn't a problem and that, you know, this was safe at the levels you were exposed to through eating food. Now, what's interesting about this particular study, that which is one of many one could have used, one I could have cited, is so you get this study. It came out in, I think, 2013, 2014, and it claimed that exposure to BPA led to breast tumors, breast cancer in rodents, which is very scary. And of course, that's how it was reported in the press. And one of the researchers said, you know, the science is clear. And this, you know, if we fail to do anything about it, this is a policy failure at this point. Now, this is not an industry-funded study. This is a government-funded study. So I began hearing problems from people at the EPA about the statistics. So I got the study, sent the statistics off to a statistician, Stanley Young, who's director of the assistant director of the National Institute of Statistical Sciences, and said, well, do the statistics show a dose-response relationship? You know, can you actually make a claim that these tumors were a result of being exposed to BPA? And he said, there is no dose-response relationship, none, which is what I had heard from contacts in the EPA and FDA, and they were furious that this blatantly false claim was being treated as causal. So complaints ensue, and the final publication version of the study, so where it says cause, might cause, you know, probable. They simply just added in a layer of language to ratchet down the causality. But it didn't, the data didn't support even the data didn't justify this public study ever being published. So it deserved being published, but for showing the opposite, that there was no relationship. And this is an extraordinary example of how, you know, there can be bias on what we assume that there's this sort of narrative that's out there where don't trust industry, trust independent science, trust government science. But really, we need to look at all the data. We need to look at all the data and treat all sides equally and with equal skepticism in order to know whether claims are valid or not.
Now, one of the problems with a lot of research is that something is found to be bad and the policy response might be, we're going to ban it. And there is no consideration given to
unintended consequences
of that ban.
Well, one of the things that a lot of people, so it's interesting, the FDA and the EPA have fought a stellar campaign to sort of show that when you do large multi-generational reproductive toxicity studies, you cannot replicate the claims that BPA is dangerous. So they've done an amazing job. Of course, they've largely been ignored by the media, which is a real problem. But The problem is the marketplace will respond to all those scare stories. And what is the probable outcome in this case? You will replace BPA with something else that's less well-tested. So you increase the probability of there being a risk where, in fact, previously there was no risk or very little risk.
The precautionary principle at work.
Yeah.
So lorcanide. Describe what lorcanide is.
Well, lorcanide is an example of the kind of industry bias we really have to address. And this was an antiarrhythmic drug that sort of came out in the early 80s. And there was a study done in 1980 in which they discovered that the people, 49 men who were treated with lorcanide, nine of them died. They had heart attacks. And only one in the placebo group. So this is a major alarm. Klaxon's going off. But the study was never submitted for publication. Scroll on 12 years, you have what's known as the CAST trial, which was suspended because similar drugs, drugs of a similar class, were being were leading to patient deaths. And I was like, oh my gosh. 1993, that original 1980 study was published. There are, I think, quite reasonable estimations that had we known about that study in 1980, maybe over 100,000 lives in the U.S. might have been saved. So that's the problem of one kind of publication bias, which is you don't publish your study, your results at all. And so one of the things that we are actually running, Sense About Science is running and launched just recently, is the All Trials campaign, which is a campaign for clinical trial transparency. And that is harnessing the passion of researchers, patients. We had over 60 patient groups and institutions supporting us when we launched, in order to persuade not only the FDA to implement the law on clinical trial registration and reporting, but to persuade the pharmaceutical industry to do the right thing. Now, you might think that's a fool's errand. But in fact, there is a social change happening here. And there are progressives at places like Johnson & Johnson and GSK who really do believe and are acting on the beliefs that this data should be shared for the benefit of all, for other researchers to look at. And it's really gratifying to be part of this campaign to implement this and also then extend it to government studies, NGO studies. We think the public should have all the data on the table. And we think, in particular, that we need to get statisticians and journalists who are statistically savvy or collaborating with statisticians to ask what's a good experiment, what's a bad experiment, what did the data really say?
If you have a question for Trevor Butterworth from Sense About Science USA and stats.org, you can tweet it at me. That's at the hashtag CatoConnects and at CO Brown, my Twitter handle. So you talked about a study that was produced in the 80s that was not published for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And you point to Lisa Schwartz and Stephen Wallachin saying, would you trust the results if only half the votes were counted or reported? Imagine if the winner of the election was the one who decided which half the voting was reported. That would be crazy, but that's not where the situation is when trials are not reported. So
yeah.
What does it mean that all these trials are registered or made public?
So there are a couple of things. So American taxpayers have funded something that's actually really good, and that's clinicaltrials.gov. And it's like if you can imagine the Library of Alexandria reimagined for the 21st century for medicine and clinical trials. And anybody in the world can register their trial there and report the summary results, which is what doctors need. They need the summary results. They don't need individual patient data, which is a whole other issue of privacy and complication. Our best estimates are that, 50% of all clinical trials have never been published and their results have not been reported. And that's particularly significant because most of the drugs we use come from this golden, what's considered almost a golden age in drug discovery in the 1990s. If we're missing so much data from those trials, this is the point where we need to know. We need to know, are the medicines in current use effective? Is there data that can actually show they could have adverse effects that we didn't realize? So, and importantly, and what's really interesting from the platform that GSK has built is that researchers want to use that data in novel ways. So of the 70-odd requests for data that GSK had, the majority, over 66 or so, were to use that data for novel inquiry. There were four fact-checking studies or whatever, but it was really to improve the quality, the amount of data so we can solve problems better. And I think the moment we are at in intellectual history, if I can go to the 30,000 foot level, is one where we are reimagining a vital component of the Enlightenment, which was the goal to share knowledge for the benefit of mankind. We are seeing the development of all sorts of data collaboratives, citizen science, people wanting to solve problems, connections and collaborations between government, NGOs, and business to actually improve the world. I am incredibly optimistic about that. But the only way it works is if the data is there and we have the best people for figuring out whether the data is good at the table, which is to say, statisticians. And of course, that's why we're in this collaboration with the American Statistical Association, which is we've created this advisory board. Six statisticians are volunteering their time to help journalists on deadline look at these kinds of studies and say, was the study design able to answer the question that the scientists wanted to ask? Is the data good? Or is this really a waste not only of everybody's time, but taxpayers' money?
Is there any conclusion that can be drawn, or even an inference really, that can be drawn about this division between what are called industry studies and what are called either government or independent studies? Is there anything we can say with clarity about those two categories of studies?
Well, we can absolutely we've seen with the pharmaceutical industry that there is publication bias, there's the reluctance to publish results, which is very troubling. But on the other hand, we've also seen within the NIH and within the growth of the research integrity movement that an awful lot of medical research and psychological research and life sciences in particular cannot be replicated. And there may be many reasons for this, but the NIH themselves, that is Francis Collins, the head of the NIH, said it's clear that a lot of researchers don't know how to design experiments. These are the experiments, and these are based on studies of government-funded science. So again, it's a mistake. If you only ever talk about motive, you're never going to answer the fundamental question. Are these claims justified by the research?
And this has been called an epidemic of deficient reporting.
Yeah.
You point to a perspective piece that is a call for transparent reporting to optimize the predictive value of preclinical research.
An extraordinary paper. For those of you, the nerds out there, written by Story Landis, a product of a workshop at the NIH. And they identify all sorts of problematic, really, really disturbingly problematic aspects, from basic failures of randomization to more complex design issues. I was just at the Joint Statistical Meetings in Seattle, which is a sort of conclave of thousands of statisticians. And, talking to them, you hear horror stories. In the data sense, horror stories, but they could lead to horror stories. And it's like they have, a doctor comes to the statistician at a hospital and says, hey, I've done this experiment, here's all this data, can you make sense of it for me? And the statistician will go, well, did you randomize? This is an actual example, I'm not quoting any names. And the doctor said, well, I said, did you randomize it? And the doctor said, sorta. And what she said was, it's a yes or no answer. If it's if you can't say yes, I can do nothing for you. You can't make something statistical out of no data. If the data, you know, data not produced with the wrong experiment is just not meaningful. So, and I think there's a great recognition within the statistical community that they need to be involved in study design from the get-go. There needs to be much more collaboration between statisticians and scientists. And I think this is a great thing because it's happening at a moment where you have new techniques and new tools and new insights into that can really produce much more reliable knowledge.
All right, we have a question here from Michelle Minton. What is the best example of poor science reporting that you've seen in recent years?
Oh, dear. I think I would have to say overall, if you're talking about a body of work, I would say BPA is a huge failure. Because if you look at it just from the point of view of what, if you're an ordinary reader, do you need to know in order to make sense of this story? Well, you kind of need to know what the risk assessments conducted by government say. And we did, you know, I did lots of looking at this, and the kind of key risk assessments were actually done in Europe. They were massive, and they were done every 2 years. And Europe, and they were operating under the precautionary principle, and yet they found there was no, they refuted the sort of tsunami of alarmism that surrounded this issue. But were they reported? No. I mean, we actually had totted up the numbers. That we think only in a 5-year period, the EFSA risk assessments were only mentioned 6% of stories. And when they were mentioned by an industry source, so they got the industry framing, even though they weren't industry funded. So that to me was really, you know, that's not fair, guys. Come on. There are one of the other great problems is, of course, nutrition research, which is immensely hard to do and easily politicized. And there are all sorts of claims about, you know, sort of big food corrupting we had one recently about Coca-Cola corrupting the evidence. And they cited, for instance, this study that appeared in PLOS Medicine, which claimed that there was concrete evidence of bias. That actually, when you looked at that study, you found the researchers left out lots of key things, like studies not funded by industry, which didn't find an association. And it really became, and I wrote a piece for the Harvard Business Review on this, because it really, you know, we talk about, oh, the need for warning labels on everything. A lot of research should come with a warning label, and that is you need to be statistically savvy to understand whether this says what it says it is.
So within nutrition, which is a broad area, we've heard a lot of, at least in the 90s and 2000s, we heard a lot about cholesterol.
Yes.
So let me ask you, as related to that, how culpable are federal agencies when it comes to people who make decisions based upon data that turns out to be deeply flawed?
Well, it's interesting. I reviewed the big fat surprise, Nina Teicholz's book on the whole sort of dietary fat issue for the Wall Street Journal. And I think the blame there, it's really extraordinary series of events that led to, you know, sort of the dietary guide recommendations.
Gary Taubes has written about this
as
well.
I actually think the problem, sadly, was with government, not so much the agencies, because the people writing, you know, again, this whole issue played to very deep concerns about, you know, the epidemic of heart attacks in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And you had Ancel Keys was a charismatic researcher who was able to explain why did Eisenhower get it's because he was eating too much steak, Eisenhower had a heart attack, and slowly a media narrative began, and we all look for, you know, there's some very interesting research going on into how we communicate and talk about science. Dan Kahan at Yale has done really interesting stuff, really, really interesting stuff. And he's really quite a character, really entertaining to listen to. But we talk about all the cognitive shortcuts that we make. that, you know, we tend to, you know, if my friend who is, I think, is very smart tells me that, oh, I read, you know, I did the, read this and read that, you know, we all tend to look for the shortest possible explanation for what we should do, because really, you cannot become an expert in these fields. But unfortunately, that shortcuts the hard work of taking things apart. And so one of the things, you know, we Stents About Science, want to see statistics and statisticians really involved in all of these debates, because the insight that, you know, Florence Nightingale said statistics was the most important science in the world. And she was right.
So which, in terms of media outlets, of course, I mean, I was a reporter for many years, so I can say, I'm allowed to say that reporters work very hard, but reporters can be lazy when it comes to meeting deadlines and the pressures that they face. So what are some things that you'd say to reporters, this is the most basic thing you need to be doing in terms of making sure that your story is not proven to be false?
I was a science writer for Newsweek for a while, and I share this challenge. I mean, you've got, if you're lucky, you have 12 or 24 hours to put together a story with a conflicting viewpoint, with a sexy title, and then you have, you know, you have editors trying to cut back your words, and then you end up with a piece that's shorter than the press release about the study to begin with, and which is, so you have no meaningful space in which to raise any of these questions. My view is that, well, what I see, again, I'm a very hopeful person. I went to Columbia Journalism School. I've witnessed the birth of the internet and the sort of the endless tragedy of print media trying to survive in straitened economic times. But I have absolutely great hope for the future. I think publications like 538, Vox, Julia Beluz is doing a must read reporter on the scientific integrity beat, and she's really good at explaining complex topics. We had BuzzFeed do a 3,500 word piece on deworming. Now you might think, well, deworming, why do I want to read about that? But actually, Ben Goldacre, who founded the All Trials campaign, made this absolutely compelling argument for how to understand the importance of evidence in public policy. And they gave him 3,500 words for that. That is the kind of revolutionary stuff I want to see. And I want to see journalists collaborate when they can with statisticians to ask basic questions. Does this data look good for you? To you? Or what should I be aware of? And we've had plenty of experience of that happening. And when journalists actually get a chance to sit down and talk about their stories through the you know, with numbers, you know, talk about the numbers, how to think about this statistically and mathematically and scientifically, usually it's a great experience. They come out jazzed, energized. And so I want to see editors give the reporters more time to do science stories. So that they can develop these relationships and use these services to provide the kind of nuanced and analytically credible journalism that, of all people, Joseph Pulitzer said they should be, you know, he was a huge fan of statistics. So, and he said, you can find truth there if you know where, how to get it. Well, you know what? Not everybody can be a Nate Silver in journalism. But we want to provide everybody with an access to a Nate Silver.
All right. Arthur Lipper has a question. How much duplication of research should be permitted using government funds?
Do you mean duplication or replication? I mean, I think we need to take replication. We need to take negative studies seriously in the sense that there's got to be more attention paid to null results that didn't find anything. They're just as valuable as we need, but we need more replication. We have to. That's the basis of science. It's not sexy. But at the same time, if the kind of procedures that, you know, Francis Collins is trying to be implement. I mean, the NIH has been doing all sorts of kind of projects to try and figure out, solve these problems. If we can get statisticians and scientists collaborating from the get-go, what do you want to know? We can improve the efficiency of science. And I think that's, if there's one lesson any person on Capitol Hill would take away from that, from this talk, that would be the lesson.
There are biases everywhere. We all have our biases. I mean, not me, of course, but everyone else does. Everybody has biases. So when it comes to the bias of academia, it seems to be, again, if it's new, if it's counterintuitive, if it goes against a body of research, and if it is something that will then kick off more research.
Well, that's the last thing is critical, and it really does. One of the things that all the web responses to the Kevin Falter incident, there were actually some really interesting commentary, and I think one I'd like to draw readers' attention to is really smart PhD student at Cornell, Kevin Klatt. He has a blog, NutriEvolve, and he had a really, really interesting commentary on the challenge of getting funding research, funding for research, especially in a field like nutrition, which is not as well funded, say, as cancer research. And one of the conversations we need to have is there a better way of funding science? Can we fund it in a way that makes it, that allows blue sky thinking? I mean, some of the greatest minds in our country today, and I think one of the ones that recently impressed me so much, Arthur Toga, who's a neuroscientist, and he runs an amazing project out at UCLA. He made this passionate plea to fund blue sky research, that it can't be, there can't be this manic rush to bring in funding so that the English department gets, or the university grounds gets 40% of every government grant. I mean, there is a problem here in that we're incentivizing scientists to produce positive results rather than true results or probable results. And that's a real problem. That academia has to – there are problems with academia.
All right. Pat Michaels asks, what do you think about, quote, anatomy of an epidemic in regards to stats on psychotropics?
That's an interesting and complex question that I think to answer comprehensively would have required me to do much more research in advance, and I'm not going to BS my way on that. But there's going to be some really interesting there's an embargoed paper that's going to be out on Wednesday that is very, very interesting. And there is also that actually plays to this. And I think we need to be really concerned about, certainly in psychology, the reproducibility of studies. There's Brian Nosek in Virginia has been doing great work on trying to, sort of ensure greater research integrity in psychology. So, this is the research integrity field is it's not in its infancy, but it's not quite at middle school yet. But I think it's the most interesting movement in science today. People like Johnny Ioannidis at Stanford, who's the most charming person you'd ever meet, are actually, they're building a new scientific revolution. And I think, the downstream effects of this, I hope, will be able to have much more informed conversations about all of these issues, but also more solutions.
Trevor Butterworth is director of Sense About Science USA. If you have an iOS device, you can download Cato Connects and other Cato programs. The app is Cato Audio in the App Store.